Time for the weekend. Here come the weekend, starting right here, right now. Friday, 5 p.m., time for American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, and...
Cheers, everybody. It's Friday.
My lovely wife and co-host, Toddy Morales Ryan, here as well. Now, on Fridays, we change the topic to how music changed, a very broad topic, because we're trying to cover pretty much the history of recorded music. As best as we possibly can with the little meager bits that we are able to assess from history.
It's a succinct but yet accurate description.
That's nice. I'll take that. And it starts, well, we started at the very beginning of recorded sound, and we're going to work our way up to the present. But right now we're on a topic that has us squarely in the middle of the 60s at this point. The topic is... Transistor days.
I thought you forgot for a moment.
I probably did. And we were covering popular music from January of 1955, the year that rock and roll started to chart. And we're going to take it up to 1969, all the while that transistor radio was at its peak. And I think that right now we are at the peak of the peak. Because the summer of 1966, was probably the year that I most remember transistor radio being used on a real, incredibly prolific basis. Everybody had transistor radios. And we'll get into that a little bit more. But this is show number 40 on that topic. Imagine, we've been doing this now.
We've come a long way, baby.
This is going to be a full year-long topic. I didn't know that when we started it. I never do. But here we are. We find ourselves in early summer, 1966, for part 40. And the juggernaut that constituted pop music in 1966 continued unabated as summer rolled around. Try to imagine hearing all of these songs in this show for the first time in a period of 30 or 40 days of your life. It just boggles my mind to think that music was ever that good. The inspiration caused by the British invasion started to bear fruit here in America, causing one of the richest eras in pop music history. The best of the British groups were all peaking at this point while experimenting with new sounds, and at the same time, America had music coming out of garages and basements all over the country. Some of it was good enough to compete on a national level. Well, R&B slowly made its transition to soul music. This is that exact era that we are talking about right now. So let's get started right away with one of those British invasion bands that I'm talking about.
Yes.
The one that begins with the letter B and ends in Eatles. I mean, we must have played already maybe 20 songs, maybe more, by the Beatles in the past, 15 shows or so since they first debuted in America in 1964. We've already heard quite a lot of their songs. But by now, in 1966, Paul McCartney and John Lennon were almost always writing exclusively of one another by this time. Even when they did collaborate, they usually wrote their parts separately and then stitched the pieces together. Their competitive relationship usually inspired each of them to concoct a song that would be the next Beatles single. Paperback Writer was Paul McCartney's submission, while John Lennon presented Rain as his own choice. They were released back-to-back, but the more traditionally commercial Paperback Writer was chosen for the A-side, and it eventually reached number one for 2 weeks. It's melodically dense, allegedly inspired, McCartney said, by the harmonies, the complex harmonies that the Beach Boys were using. But it's infinitely more manic than anything attempted by the Beach Boys. It's hard to even know exactly what McCartney was thinking. Furthermore, on a transistor radio, which is how most people, like I said, were listening to this music, the song Paperback Writer was so dense that it was really hard to grasp everything that was going on. It was a very busy song. It actually caused a couple people to say, oh, the Beatles, they might be vulnerable. You know, this doesn't sound as absolutely stunningly fantastic as everything else that they've done. You know, shut up, everybody. It was the number one song.
Yeah.
And you know what? It was really great for its time, and it still sounds great now. So let's start our show with the Beatles' A-side of their double-sided hit single called Paperback Writer on American Radio, 90.3 WHBC. Paperback Writer's Eye. Yet another number one hit racked up by the Beatles from June of 1966. Now, Billboard bounced around a lot, Heidi, doing changing their rules about how they would handle chart positions of double-sided hit singles. Sometimes they would, if the record sold a certain amount, they would assign the same chart position to the A side and the B side, or sometimes they would just call the second side flip and then assign that number to it because it was attached to the other side. But at this point in time, each record was charting individually, which is really tough because how do you know?
That's how reported plays are, right?
Yeah, but the thing is, they were also going by sales. So if they were going to say, well, okay, we're going to put all of the sales to the A side and play, well, then of course the A side's going to be, you know, number one or a higher position, while the B-side wouldn't chart nearly as high. And that's the case here because John Lennon's song, Rain, only rose as high as number 23.
Whoa.
So I don't know if Paperback Writer got that much more airplay is my point. So it might have been based on assigning most of the sales to one side.
Mm.
Now, while Paul McCartney took his first cautious steps towards experimentation with Paperback Writer, John Lennon jumped headlong into the deep end of the pool. You know, this is certainly, in my opinion, one of the most interesting singles to ever enter the top 40. John Lennon writes strangely morose lyrics. They sound like they're drug-induced. He was up late one night and he was actually working on the mix of the song and he queued up his own vocal track backward and he liked it enough and he kept it that way and released it. I'm almost surprised that he didn't release the whole song backwards because that's kind of where Lennon's mind was at. But as far as playing on this song, it certainly contains one of Paul McCartney's most fascinating bass guitar lines. It's twisting and turning and always interesting. And since we're talking about the rhythm section, Ringo Starr certainly puts in an inspired performance that might be the highlight of his playing career as well. So be sure to listen to the rhythm section as the Beatles play Rain on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. still fascinating to this day. And it's a harbinger of things to come with the Beatles, certainly that single. So let's have one more track then, since we're coming. This isn't really me arranging the songs in any particular order. In fact, I'm absolutely not arranging them in an order. I'm playing them in the strict chronological order of when they appear and then chart position. So number one before number 23, for example, that sort of thing. And if the month changes, then we move forward. And that's exactly where we're at now. Dusty Springfield has been one of the more interesting vocalists to come out of the British invasion. And amazingly, I don't think anybody expected her to last a full 3 years on the American charts, but she did. And here she is with a number four hit, the song that eventually rose to number four. And wow, what an intro on this song. This sounds like what you would hear in a Cecil B. DeMille movie, like when the seas are parting and what the music would have to do at some incredible climactic point. In fact, the orchestration practically dares Dusty Springfield to oversing. The fact that she shows restraint is a small miracle in itself. A lesser performer would break into octave-leaping screeches with fireworks going off in the background. But Dusty knows how to play it cool. And I think it's what saves this song, and I think it's what makes it so awesome, even when the orchestra
She's super sultry.
Yeah, the orchestra goes to leaps and bounds to basically get around her. So it was originally an Italian ballad with all that Italian emotion that you would imagine, and lyrics written by Simon Napier Bell and Vicky Wickham, who worked on Ready, Steady, Go with her. They wrote the American, the English lyrics for the song. You don't have to say you love me. On American at Radio, 90.3 WHBC.
When I say it wasn't me who changed, but you. And now you've gone away. Don't you see that now you've gone, and I'm left here on my own, that I have to follow you.
Not to pick too heavily on contemporary singers, but I keep thinking, what would have happened if Mariah Carey, for example, was given that arrangement?
Oh, my God.
You can only imagine how many crazy, right? Even through the modulation, Dusty keeps her cool. It's Amazing. All right. Now, all these English songs that we've been listening to from 1964 until now, the middle of 1966, are starting to take real effect on American culture. And I mean, in a fundamental way, every kid, you know, male anyway, began to pick up an instrument and learn how to play and, you know, get into their garage or their basement. And that's where these next couple of songs take us. My favorite garage punk song is by a band called The Syndicate of Sound. Ooh. And that's what we're coming up now. I mean, what I love, records don't get any punkier than this in my mind. I mean, it is, not many songs before or since have managed to sound so unwittingly self-repugnant. There's to have a good punk record, you want the singer to sound like he's sneering, like he's a wise guy and he's, you know, he's mocking you, but a little bit of self-loathing helps. But, well, what happens, Heidi, if you have a sentence and you use a double negative? It turns it into a
positive, right?
Right. It turns it around. Well, what do you count how many negatives there are in this one phrase in the song? Just listen to this. Hey, little girl, you don't have to hide nothing no more. You haven't done nothing that hasn't been done before. It's like a double set of triple negatives. It's just absolutely unbelievable. And he's acting like he's cool because he figured out that she's cheating on him. But he forgets to accept, well, dude, she's cheating on you. And he's like, you know, and when he says she hasn't, nothing hasn't been done, like, you know, hey, this happens to him all the time. It's, of all the punk rock songs that were popular in the second half of the 70s, none captured so succinctly the humor or the art of confident self-loathing as well as Syndicate of Sound did with Little Girl a full decade earlier. I love this song on American radio. Here is the Syndicate of Sound with Little Girl. Genius, American style. This is what was, this is like America's reaction pretty much. And it's a whole new breed of rock and roll all of a sudden. Now, this next band, pretty much the same thing. And in this case, I can say, thank God for the Rolling Stones. You know, by reestablishing rock and roll as a distasteful and rude musical genre, They caught the interest of every pimple-faced adolescent kid with a bad attitude and inspired them with the idea that they too could write, sing, and play annoying music. Across America, garage bands rehearsed a handful of three-chord songs that they copped from the radio, while the better of the lot wrote a few of their own. And these garage punk bands unknowingly laid the groundwork for removing the old vanguard and replacing it with anarchy. Now, again, one of the best was the Standells. They were more or less typical of the garage band genre, but their songwriter-producer was anything but. His name was Ed Cobb. And his resume, he was actually a member of the vocal group The Four Preps. Pretty cheesy. But he's also a songwriter. He had written songs like Tainted Love. Yeah, that yeah. one. He wrote Every Little Bit Hurts, and he wrote this song called Dirty Water.
Ooh.
Now, you could call them, you know, basically garage punk, but the Standells could also qualify as the original Hollywood Brat Pack. The right. band leader, Larry Tamblyn, was actor Russ Tamblyn's brother. The guitarist, Dick Dodd, was an ex-Mouseketeer. Now, Cobb wrote this. Now, so they're obviously living in L.A.
Right.
And Cobb wrote the song about Boston, about 3,000 miles away from the Standells. But why would a little few miles get in the way when you have a great song? Okay. Doesn't mean a thing. So on American Radio 90.3 WHPC, here they are singing Dirty Water. So here you come out of that situation where you get up like a battle of the bands, like England versus America, with completely different sounds and styles out of the both of them now. But America obviously squarely influenced by what came from England. So let's go back to England.
By that course, you can say they were influenced by the blues.
Yeah, definitely. Because that's what, well, the Rolling Stones, for example, right. But the songwriting, it eventually evolved and became something a little bit more youth-oriented.
Yes.
Right. So speaking of that, okay, the Animals, definitely one of the most, the bands most influenced by the blues in England. And in fact, so much so that it was almost like to the point of parody. But by late 65 and 1966, they were getting most of their songs out of the Brill Building here. They weren't writing their own material anymore. I mean, songs like We Gotta Get Out of This Place and It's My Life were basically Brill Building songwriters. And this next track, Don't Bring Me Down, one of my favorites by the band, was written by Jerry Goffin and Carole King. So they're a pop band now, and they're relying on the American songwriting teams that were responsible for the hits of the girl group sound and all that stuff from the 60s. Here we go then with the Animals performing Don't Bring Me Down on 90.3 WHBC. So the Animals changed their sound, moving away from the blues to do something that was more commercial and poppy. And it worked great for them. And I think that the song, they became a better band for it.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing was, I mean, well, the blues were not as popular in 1966 in pop music anyway, as it was in, say, 62 and 63. So there was a change. And that's because there was so much innovation happening in the pop music world. So let's bring it back to America and basically play two different styles of what R&B was doing in 1966, because we have back-to-back R&B songs, and I think it makes for an interesting comparison. One side, we have Motown up north, of course, in Michigan. And on the other side, we have Stax, of course, in the South. And it's very interesting to hear the two different styles. One of them, rather sophisticated, the Motown, very sophisticated pop.
Thusly, why they were giving everybody elocution lessons. And
yes, exactly. My God, getting all the stuff. Etiquette and elocution and all that. You know, dance lessons. They were slick. Even the names were slick. James Jamerson and Benny Benjamin. You know, how mellifluous is that? And that's the rhythm section on this track by The Temptations. Now, we had already told the story about how Smokey Robinson was responsible for writing all of their material up until the point last week where they made a bet and said that if he didn't get a top 10 hit, he was going to move on. Well, Smokey got elevated to, he became management at Motown. So he had a lot to do. So his songwriting, he couldn't pay as much attention to it anyway. So Norman Whitfield moved in and he had this song just waiting. And although it didn't quite make the top 10, it did go to number 13 and it made a very deep impression. So we're going to start the set with The Temptations, Ain't Too Proud to Beg. Ooh. And from there, we're going to move to Memphis to Stax Records with Sam and Dave performing an Isaac Hayes and David Porter song. Listen to the two really drastically different styles of soul music, because that's pretty much what it's becoming now. It's really, you don't even call it R&B anymore. It's become something else. So listening to these two songs will show you the Northern soul side and the Southern gritty soul side on American at Radio, 90.3 WHPC.
Sympathy, I don't mind, 'cause you mean that much to me. Ain't too proud to beg, and you know it. Please don't leave me, girl.
Sam Moore and Dave Prater, otherwise known as Sam and Dave.
Yeah.
Trading verses back and forth on that. I don't know. Did I mention that was written by Isaac Hayes and David Porter?
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, it's their song. And it's Booker T and the MGs backing them up, and the Marquees playing all the horns.
It's a winning combination.
That's like a Memphis superstar track. So you hear, like, right there, the difference of what's going on back and forth in the soul market there. Now, somebody who's been around since the 50s, Ray Charles, is still around, still relevant. I guess he was relevant his whole life, as long as he was able to, you know, sing and perform. And this next song, I didn't know this, but it was originally performed by the Coasters and eventually covered by Ronnie Millsap in 1965. And it was written by Ashford and Simpson with a woman named Josephine Armstead. So that's even crazier that Ashford and Simpson wrote Let's Go Get Stoned, right? Charles was just released from rehab after a 16-year heroin addiction, and he hears Ronnie Millsap sing Let's Go Get Stoned, and he decides he's going to perform it. He doesn't care if he's just out of rehab. It's too amazing if you think about it, but there it is. On American Day Radio, 90.3 WHPC, Ray Charles proven that he's tough. Performing Let's Go Get Stoned on American Day Radio.
Wait a minute. You know my baby. She won't let me in. I've got a few pennies. I'm gonna buy myself a bottle of gin. And then I'm gonna call my buddy on the telephone and say, so hard all day long. Everything I try to do seems to always turn out wrong. That's why I want to stop by on my way home and say, now let me tell you one more thing. Have a little taste, but don't lose your cool and start messing up the man's place. Ain't no harm to take a little nip, but don't you fall down and bust your lid. No, no. Everybody ought to come on and go with me.
All right, so let's go back to England for
again?
One more song. Hey, why not? We can go around and around. Right now, we are still in June of 1966. This is the way that things moved in 1966. I mean, if you're trying to, like, move through time quickly by playing the best songs, it becomes almost like a glacier fast. And 'cause every time you turned on the radio, you'd hear a new fabulous song. It must have been just, I remember it living, just every time I turned on a transistor radio, I couldn't believe what I heard. I was constantly getting goosebumps. And it was all these amazing songs that just kept coming out of that little speaker. The Kinks were quickly becoming one of the, like, best underground bands out of the British invasion. And The one thing that went along with the British invasion, by the way, was an amazing run toward fashion. Everybody having to wear the latest, the best. It seemed like every 2 months you had to buy new clothes in order to stay hip.
Oh, yeah.
And Ray was at a party and he met a fashion designer and they got into it. They got into an argument. And in fact, it literally turned into a brawl.
Oh my God.
Ray says it was a flat out fight between him and the fashion designer. Basically blaming them for being manipulative and playing with everybody, toying with everybody for money. And he went home and he wrote a song. He said he wrote it really quick because he was in a bit of a rage and he was so angry at the fashion designer that he even begins to mock in like a certain lispy voice the way that he was talking to him. And that's how the song got constructed the way that it is. So it's basically a lampoon of British fashion and it's done incredibly well and with deep cleverness. On American Radio 90.3 WHBC, here are the Kinks with Dedicated Follower of Fashion.
They seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds round the boutiques of London town, eagerly pursuing all the latest fads and trends, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is.
Thinks he is a flower to be looked at, and when he pulls his frilly nylon and his raked up tight, he feels a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is.
There's one thing that he loves, and that is flattery. One week he's in polka dots, and next week he's in stripes, but he's a dedicated follower of fashion. They seek him here, they seek him there, in Regent Street and Leicester Square. Everywhere the Carnavician army marches on, each one a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is.
His world is built round discotheques and parties. His pleasure-seeking individual always looks his best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is.
He flits from shop to shop just like a butterfly. In matters of the cloth he is as fickle as can be, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. He's a dedicated follower of fashion.
Quite honestly, if you did turn on the radio in 1966, you may have heard that a few times. It was like more of a regional hit because it didn't get very high. It peaked at number 36. The Kinks just really had a tough road to hoe here in America and in their own country too. They just never got the respect that they deserved. Now, I want to read something. I wrote this, Heidi, 30 years ago, 30 years before I ever would have had any idea that I might be on the radio doing a show called Transistor Days. But this is what I wrote. It would be hard to exaggerate the importance of the transistor radio on mid-60s rock and roll. In the 50s, a common place for most kids to hear rock and roll radio was in their parents' cars, cruising Main Street on Saturday nights. By the mid-60s, though, the transistor had made radios both cheap and portable, so every kid could take one wherever they went. A trip to the park or the beach was considered incomplete without bringing along the radio. Best of all, you didn't need a driver's license to have access. So Radio Fest became the property of adolescents as well as older teenagers. Music was now able to penetrate every minute of our leisure hours. Anyone who ever did it will always remember the thrill of going to bed with the radio pressed against the pillow and listening clandestinely while some DJ at a faraway station played rock and roll records all night long. It was romantic because it fired your sleepy imagination and because it freed your mind to roam across the miles with a radio signal, making sleep all but impossible. I wrote that in like 1987.
Aww,
and
so good.
I wrote it because I remember distinctly hearing Summer in the City by Lovin' and the Spoonful with the radio underneath my pillow. And it still, to me, to this day, is the best AM radio hit song I think I've ever heard. It just is perfect. It's got the right amount of treble, great guitars, great melodies, sound effects, everything. American at Radio 90.3 WHBC. Here are the Lovin' Spoonful with Summer in the City.
Shadow in the city, all around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match, yeah. But at night it's a different world, go out and find a girl, come on and dance all night, despite the heat it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity, the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city. Meeting in the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat looking for a kitty, gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop, running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop. But at night it's a different world, go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night, despite the heat it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity, the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city.
Song built for transistor radios. All right, I got very little time, and I got two more to get in. So let's do this real quick. A song written by Chip Taylor that was originally given to a band called the Wild Ones in 1965, and it went absolutely nowhere. The Trogs were a popular band in England that decided to pick it up and do a cover version of it, and they end up with a number one hit doing the same song. So we're going to start with that, and we're going to follow that up by coming back to America with Bobby Hebb. Bobby Hebb had a really, really bad day on November 22nd, 1963. That's the day that President Kennedy was shot. That was bad enough. And then his brother was killed in a nightclub that night.
Oh, my God.
All in one day. He woke up and he was devastated and he just wanted to see if he could get in touch with some positivity to get the devastation that was in his soul. And he wrote the song Sunny. And it became a huge hit as well. So basically, talk about making lemonade out of lemons. Bobby Hebb gets first prize. So we start with the Trogs, Wild Thing, and we'll end with Bobby Hebb performing Sunny on American Radio 90.3 WHPC. Take care, everybody. I had a great time doing this show. Hope you had a lot of fun listening, and we will be back next week. Enjoy the weekend. Bye-bye.
Yesterday my life was filled with rain. Sunny, you smiled at me and really eased the pain. Now the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you. Sunny, thank you for the sunshine bouquet. Sunny, thank you for the love you've brought my way. You gave to me your all in all, and now I feel 10 feet tall. Sunny one so true, I love you. Sunny, thank you for the truth you let me see. Sunny, thank you for the facts from A to Z. My life was torn like windblown sand, then a rock was formed when we held hands. Sunny, sunny one so true, I love you. Spark of nature's fire, you're my sweet, complete desire. Sunny one so true, yes, I love you. Sunny, yesterday all my life was filled with rain. Sunny, you smiled at me and really, really eased the pain.
I love you.